Good morning and welcome to this May 20th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. It's my pleasure to welcome short story writer Ethan Rutherford and journalist Barry Newman to the show this morning. Ethan is with me now. Barry will join me for the second half of the show, so stay tuned for that. Ethan Rutherford was born in Seattle and now lives in the Midwest. His stories have appeared or are forthcoming in Plowshares, One Story, American Short Fiction, New York Tyrant, Aesopus Five Chapters, and the Best American Short Stories. His work has received special mention in the 2009, 2010, and 2013 editions of the Pushcart Prize. He's received awards from the McKnight Foundation and the Minnesota State Arts Board. He received his MFA from the University of Minnesota and has taught creative writing at McAllister, the University of Minnesota, and Loft Literary Center. He is the guitarist for a band, Penny Royal. We'll find out more about that, which has been, he says, assaulting the ears of its listeners with Songs of the Ocean and Long Lost Love since 2010. He's currently at work on a novel set in the Alaskan wilderness. His first book is The Peripatetic Coffin and Other Stories. It's named a Barnes & Noble Discover Great Writers Pick, a Best Book for the Summer by Publishers Weekly, and longlisted for the Frank O'Connor Award. It was also a finalist for the John Leonard Prize, the LA Times Art Siedenbaum Award, received an honorable mention for the Penn Hemingway Award, and is a winner for the Minnesota Book Award. It deserves all of it. It is fantastic. It's what we're going to talk about this morning. Ethan, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you on.
That was a wonderful mouthful.
That was a long. That was a
tell her all those nice things that you just said.
That was a long introduction to all of your amazing works. I want to talk about all of it. I actually got to know you through, I put something up on Facebook a couple of weeks ago saying that May is Short Story Month. And I asked my friends, who are all avid readers, for their favorite short stories. And the first one mentioned was you. So I sought you out in One Story and then became acquainted with your collection and totally fell in love with it and called you up. So that's how you got on the show.
Wonderful. That's so nice to hear. Thank all your Facebook friends for me.
Yeah, I will. I'm sure they're listening. So I'm going to give you a chance to just kind of talk about the collection as a whole, how it came together. The stories are really very different from each other. You've got sci-fi stories and historical stories and, you know, from all different points of view. But there's really a center of gravity to the collection. We'll talk about some of those themes. But maybe just talk a little bit about the collection in general, how it came together, how the stories were chosen, and kind of what was intriguing to you when you were, what themes were intriguing to you when you were putting it together.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very funny to look back at the book that you happened to create, you know, sort of a couple years after it came out. In some ways, it's both a little bit more of a mystery to me, but it also is a little bit more legible. I mean, I think when I was putting the book together, I was thinking very much along, this is also when the music stuff was really sort of happening. We were putting albums together at the same time that I was putting the short story collection together. And I started thinking about the book the way that you would think about an album, in that these short stories aren't explicitly connected. You know, characters don't recur. They don't sort of occur even in sort of the same time period. There's stories that are set way back in history. There's a sort of a sci-fi story at the very end. So all of the stories are distinct, the way that you would sort of think about songs, but to some degree they were kind of all singing in the same key. So when it came time to put them together, I started thinking about the book as an album. You know, what do you want the first track to be? Do you put the strongest story in the first, is the first thing that people read, or do you save that for sort of the end? And so the idea was to arrange the stories in a way that offered like an experience that the reader could, you know, hopefully, if you progress from one story from the beginning to the end of the book, the album is somehow greater than the individual songs. Whether or not that's how people navigate short story collections, that's how I like to do it, but I don't know if that's how most readers do go through short story collections. But so when I started thinking about the album, I looked at all the stories that I had written, and it was sort of clear that I had, there were sort of two groups of stories. One group was what I would sort of call the farther away stories, which are sort of stories set generally aboard boats, where generally bad things happen, like the boat will explode, like at the end of the story. So there's this, there was a story about the first Confederate submarine during the Civil War. There's a story about a crew aboard a sort of a Russian ship that's locked in the ice. There's a story about a contemporary story about a father and a son in a boat on the coast of Vancouver Island, and then another boat story that's set in the future. And those were the stories that I started to think of as the further away stories, where a lot of research was informing how those stories took shape. And then splitting that sort of down the middle, there were those four stories, and then there were four stories that I would sort of consider them to be closer to home stories. They're more sort of contemporary. They sort of dealt with more kind of familiar domestic issues, what I would consider to be familiar domestic issues. How do parents navigate being parents to a son who is upset and depressed as he's sort of coming home and kind of circling and making life difficult. So I was looking at these eight stories, and the question became, you know, how do these stories relate to each other? You know, if you put them in sort of different order, is there a resonance that can come through this, through if you listen to the thing as a whole? And so I worked with my editor, and we essentially had note cards. So, you know, what happens if we put this story here and that story there? And finally, we kind of found the order that we were the most happy with.
That's great. That's great. You know, this may be more observation than question, but one thing occurred to me, because I read a lot of women writers or some women's issues, that these stories were really distinctly male, and I loved that. That I don't get a huge opportunity often to read stories about men, men with men, men thinking about men things. Men things.
Yeah, boats, explosions.
Right, right. And it struck me as oddly refreshing, and that in the realm of short stories, there are certainly a lot of male short story writers, obviously. But these issues felt very centralized on sort of men's issues, men coming of age or boys coming of age, a father's perspective on, you know, how on parenting and mother, you know, kind of caring for his son the best way he knew how, and the father sort of stepping into the mothering role with his son. Yeah, it was a really interesting perspective that I feel like we don't get enough of.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I mean, it to some degree that is a little bit of you know, you sort of say, sort of write what you know. And I, as the book was coming together, I was going to be, my wife was pregnant with our first son. And so I became sort of very interested in sort of what does it mean to be sort of, what does fatherhood mean? And how do you sort of, how do you navigate these kind of different roles? The story that you mentioned earlier, the story that was in one story, which is called Summer Boys, I think is the one story where that was the first time I was sort of explicitly trying to write, because you do read a lot of short stories by men that are sort of about male issues, and to some degree, sometimes that can feel like hitting the same gong over and over and over. You know, and I certainly went through a phase where I was writing sort of stories that were sort of Carver-esque, and you know, sort of this, you know, the lonely male who's too hard to crack and that sort of stuff. And I think that Summer Boys, which is the story about sort of the young friendship between the two 10-year-old boys, was the first time that I really felt like I was trying to write a story that I hadn't seen before, which is a story about sort of a tenderness and a real love that exists between sort of young friends at that particular sort of age. And I'm glad to hear that resonated with you.
Yeah. So I read it in one story first, and then I read it in the collection, and there were just a couple of tweak changes. The third male character who comes in had a name change between the two stories, I think.
Yes.
And I feel like a comma was added to the title, which to me, I have the book on my Kindle, but in the book, in the collection, there was no comma between Summer and Boys. Is that true? Or was the comma added later?
I believe the comma was added later.
Because it really changed the meaning for me in a really lovely way. And I thought, you know, it was much stronger with the comma. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the editing process. And, you know, once stories are out in the world, you can still tweak with them a little bit. And kind of what you were thinking in the changes and when a story is really done, if ever.
Oh, yes. Well, let me just stop you very quickly on that and say you must be the one ideal reader out there who's we're talking about commas. This is excellent. because as you know, if you're a writer yourself, that's exactly the kind of thing that you really do obsess over. It's a comma placement, you know, in a way that a comma between sort of two words can actually sort of change the meaning. I mean, to a certain extent, when you're doing it on that level, it becomes poetry to some extent, right? You're seeing what happens as sort of words collide and what kind of sparks you can get. It's wonderful to talk to somebody who actually notices comma placement.
I love comma placement. I stand by my opinion. It really does change the sort of the meaning and feel of the story. It was lovely. And actually, I really liked the name of the character in the one story over the name of the character. I think it was Jeremy in the collection, which.
The name was Elias in the first version.
Yes. Sort of seemed like alias to me.
What?
Which sort of seemed like alias to me. You know, it connoted sort of a more generic stand-in character. You know, I'm a stand-in alias person as opposed to Jeremy, which felt a little bit more generic to me.
Yeah, I love that. So we wanted to talk about sort of the change, the editing that sort of happens as you go from you publish a story in, say, a journal, and then if you're lucky, it gets collected in the book, and you get another shot at editing it. And I will say that it is one of the most sort of humbling experiences because you write these stories at a certain point in your life, and then you get a chance to take a look at them again a year later, and so many things have changed. Mm-hmm. And you go, I don't recognize necessarily the person who wrote the story, and what I really want to do is change everything about it. And you have to kind of fight that urge, you know, because the story, I really feel, and stories like songs, you sort of go, it's kind of a record of the best you could do with that sort of particular time in your life. And so talking about what happened with the way that story came out in a journal versus how it appeared in the book, the small changes that were made, I was sort of purposefully trying to kind of keep myself out of going in there and tinkering with it too much. So the comma was something that was sort of thought about a lot. There was a lot of effort that went into sort of a lot of the cultural references that placed that story in a very specific time were off by about a year or 6 months. So like a movie showed up that they wouldn't have been able to have seen, and that had to go. But the name change, I wish that there was sort of a good reason, but the only reason that it changed was because I realized that I knew an Elias, and that this suddenly when the book is going to sort of be very real, I felt I better go ahead and change that name to sort of protect the innocent, as they say.
Right.
So that's how that name changed. I think that I would have, I don't know if I should have kept it or not. It actually is the kind of thing that I didn't think that anybody would think about. And here you are, and you've caught me on it.
It's funny, I was saying to somebody the other day that I have the best book club because it's just me and the writer. And I get to ask all the questions that you'd batter around in book clubs and, you know, drink too much wine and come to no conclusions on. So it's fun to be able to, you know, pick the brain of the person who was actually making these decisions and thinking about all of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I would imagine, too, sometimes you get, you know, when the writers answer the questions, it cracks things open in a really interesting way. And other times the writer will simply say, I didn't even know that that was operating sort of under the surface or that that was something that people were picking up on.
Right.
And I had this very strange experience recently where, because a lot of the stories they're heavily researched, but I'm really kind of researching only enough to make the stories seem sort of like a durable illusion, if that makes sense. Uh-huh. So it's just enough to make you believe the world of the story and to figure out how the setting would shape the characters. And I I gave a reading recently at a where the book had been required for courses, and it's very funny too. You see students are like, well, I had to read this. I enjoyed it, but someone made me read it. You go, well, I'm glad you read it. And they had all been made to write essays on the stories, and they were finding all sorts of symbolism that I would have loved to have taken credit for that, but simply just kind of occurred, and they kind of put the pieces together. You know, and you also, you know, the one of the stories in there is about the first Confederate submarine, and that just opened up a whole window into a world of people who know so much about these particular submarines. And, you know, it's almost like as soon as I have the story, I start kind of erasing the data drive on, you know, the submarine file, so I can fill it up with a new file about, you know, the American whaling industry or, you know, early flight or something like that.
Yes, exactly, exactly. My guest this morning is Ethan Rutherford, and we are talking about his collection, The Peripatetic Coffin. Am I saying that word right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank God.
Which word, coffin? No, I'm kidding.
Coffin, exactly.
Yeah, peripatetic.
I've been saying coffin.
Yeah, you've got it. Yes, I had a very funny, it's very funny too, because people, my uncles are sort of like, aren't you fancy? Peripatetic. I was like, no, it actually makes
it's
sense.
It's really a word.
Yeah.
That's funny. I wanted to talk a little bit about the wonderful different uses of voice and whether or not it's a conscious decision. So you have one wonderful story called A Mugging, where you start sort of with the narrator kind of addressing the reader. And then in Summer Boys, which we've been talking about, you have these two sort of anonymous, unnamed boys, but you always know which one is talking to us. And in the wonderful camp story, you have a kind of unreliable, evil narrator, wonderfully
oh,
evil
yeah.
narrator. So there's a lot of really great play with voice, with point of view and style. And I was wondering if you sort of set out these challenges to yourself of, you know, I'm going to break a rule here. I'm going to try this new thing. Or if the stories organically sort of develop their voices on their own and you just sort of, you know, follow them where they take you.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I don't intend to, I don't sort of set out trying to sort of do exercises just to sort of sharpen the tools, just, you know, to see if I can do it. You know, we're going to do a story now that's all dialogue or something like that. but I find that I can't progress in a story. I can't get past that first paragraph unless the voice clicks. And so I will end up writing sort of the first paragraph and sometimes the last paragraph of my stories before they're even stories, over and over and over again until I have kind of a specific cadence or narrative strategy that for some reason is pushing the story forward in a way that I find interesting. So I didn't set out with A Mugging to talk about, you know, to say, I wonder what happens if I tell this story in the future tense, which I've never, yeah, I don't know if I've actually ever read a story that sort of does that. But that story in some ways, as I was thinking about it, it became about inevitability and sort of the crushing way that this is inevitably going to sort of drive a wedge between them. And that sort of repetition of this will happen, started to feel like it was adding, the way the story was told was adding to the themes that were perhaps sort of under the surface of the story. And with Summer Boys, it was interesting, the early versions of that story, we were talking about names earlier, both of those boys had names. Mm. And the story wasn't clicking for some reason, and I couldn't figure out what it was, and it suddenly occurred to me that this, you know, this is a story sort of about closeness and about characters who are in that sort of amazing moment in your life where you're kind of starting to assemble your own identity, but it's very fluid, and you kind of wish you were your friend, and there's a certain amount of personality swimming that kind of happens. And so, sort of on a lark, I just took their names out of the thing, and suddenly it became a story not about individuals, but about how these two boys are navigating their own relationship. And the story then became about that comma placement, right, where it's not Summer Boys anymore. It's that comma is kind of starting to insert itself between these two boys as they move from being versions of the same person to whoever it is that they're going to be. And so it's a long way of saying that I can't really go very far in a story without having kind of the narrative strategy locked in. And I've also never written a story, say, in first person and said, you know what, I think this story would be better in third person. I've tried it, and it always brings sort of an entropy to the page, and the story ends up kind of dying there for me.
Mm-hmm. God, that's great. I love listening to you talk about this. That's great. My guest this morning is Ethan Rutherford, and the collection we're talking about is The Peripatetic Coffin. The thing that I love the short story form, and I write in the short story form. I read a ton of novels as well, but one of the difficulties, I think, is containing the story, you know, that you take something to workshop and they say, well, this could be a novel. And, you know, there's so much more here. And so finding the boundaries around a short story, I think, can be a challenge. The number of characters can get out of hand, or the duration, or kind of the scope of what the story nugget is trying to tell. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about if that gives you problems too, and how you manage it, and how you decide, okay, this, you know, I've gotten away from the central nugget of what I'm trying to say here, and it's spinning out in all of these directions and reining it back in.
Yeah, no, that's really, there is always that funny like workout moment where people go, I think this might be a novel. And you go, does that mean you just hate it?
Right, exactly.
Did I just didn't do a good job, that this isn't sort of a tight Swiss clock of a piece of literature here? You're absolutely right to sort of, you know, one of the things that is hard and can be sort of a little demoralizing or overwhelming about short stories is that every piece has to really sort of too thin, as, you know, if you're thinking about sort of gears and the way that gears kind of come together, it has to sort of too thin, but it can't feel programmatic or schematic, or the whole exercise sort of falls apart, right? We read to be sort of surprised and to kind of sort of be driven into sort of a place of defamiliarization, as Charles Baxter would say, or slight, pleasurable disorientation. And one of the things that can be hard about a short story is if you know exactly, well, this inciting incident needs to happen, it then leads to this doorway moment, it then leads to X, Y, Z, it can start to feel schematic. Mm-hmm. For me, when I'm writing short stories, I know that it's a short story versus a novel if I'm writing the end first. I usually have an image that I'm writing towards. And if I have an image that I'm writing towards, I know that it's a short story, because I end up sort of, I don't start very far away from that image. And I know that I sort of have the moment that I'm kind of circling around in it, and I just have to sort of find my way to it in a way that isn't too programmatic. So you get that first paragraph and that last paragraph, and then you go, okay, I can see the design here. Now I need to find a way to kind of elegantly and organically move the story from point A to point B, and it's kind of this whole contained organism there. So the only way that I've ever been able to write a successful short story is if I know the moment that I'm going for, which doesn't mean that you hit it. Half the time you don't actually keep the ending that you thought you were going for, but I need to have that in mind in order for me to sort of, when those other characters come knocking, to simply say, you know what, this isn't the story for you guys, I know where I'm going, you can't come in. I need to keep this sort of dialed in. And I feel like with a novel, which is what I'm working on now, it's terrifying in a different way, because you characters knock on the door and you don't know if you should let them in or not, because you have no idea of knowing what is essential to the story. And so I don't know if that actually explicitly answers your question.
Does. Yeah, no, it does. It does. That's well told. And you brought up an interesting next point, which I wanted to talk about, which are short story endings. Because I think short stories, unlike novels, you know, don't wrap things up in tidy bows. And I was reading some commentary on Summer Boys, and people said, well, I know what happened, but I don't quite know what happened. And, you know, I think I get it, but I don't quite get it. And, that, you know, that was true with a lot of the stories and here, a lot of short stories in general. And I hoped you could just touch on endings. I think it's interesting that you kind of know the ending that at least you're working towards, even if that doesn't turn out to be the ending. But that sort of off kilter, unsettling feeling that short stories leave you with, and getting that note right, as opposed to novels, where if you did that in a novel, your readers would kill you. You know, they'd be like, I spent 500 pages and I don't know what happened.
Yeah, exactly right. And this, I have had a couple of people come up after and be like, so what happened? You know, it is the endings. I think the endings, I really do believe that the endings are sort of what the difference between sort of a good short story and a great short story. It all sort of happens right there at the ending. And for me, what I mean, I definitely have been accused of taking pleasure in unresolved action, which I think is true. I mean, I think that's a fair accusation. Well, I think of endings as a chance for the author to some degree, refocus the attention of the story, where it's your chance to sort of, you want it to feel like an arrival, but you also want the reader to sort of, you want to reach out towards the reader in some way and get them involved in the emotional undercurrent somehow. And one of the things that I sort of found, at least the stories that I respond to, they're the stories that they don't, you get to the end of the story, and if they sort of stop you in that sort of freeze time, if they don't tell you exactly what happened, the question then is a reader goes, okay, if this story wasn't about what happened, well, then what is it about? Mm. And then that starts, you start investigating the story in a different way, and you might sort of start the story again, or you might sort of go through to sort of figure out what it is. You know, if the author isn't telling you how these things wrapped up explicitly, well, what is it that we're supposed to sort of get from this story? It's not withholding for withholding's sake. It's the author saying, there are other things that are going on here that are complicated that I'd like you to sort of pay attention to. And I think that sometimes making very explicit, sort of tying up endings with sort of like falling action and denouement and sort of all that stuff, I feel like sometimes it can wrap up, it can actually shut a story down and flatten it out, because with its with the emphasis on sort of event and what happened, you feel like the story has in some ways been contained, and you can leave the story being like, oh, this story was about what happened to these characters. When in fact, I think the best short stories talk about not what happened, but what it felt like to go through those particular stories. And so I oftentimes will end my story sort of right before the events are about to kind of be finally resolved, and hopefully you give your readers a sense of what is going to come next without sort of necessarily knowing it. But if you hang on sort of that moment of either sort of catharsis or suspension, and you stop the action, in some ways emotion kind of rises up from the surface and fills that void. And I mean, I think that most writers would say that what they want is for someone to leave their story having felt something, right? You're trying to create emotion, stir emotion where there was none before. And so to some degree, ending without, you know, sort of, so take Summer Boys, for example, right? One of the things that's going on in there is one of the kids has been molested by an older cousin, and he's trying to sort of encompass that and figure out what that has meant. And I had a couple of different versions of that story where I made it explicit what had happened, and I found that it kind of overwhelmed what I would have otherwise thought was sort of a very tender story about sort of friendship and intimacy. And so in some ways, toning down the questions about sort of what happened or sort of obscuring it a little bit allowed what I was really interested in about the story to come to the surface, which is, yes, what happened is important, but what is more important here is the friendship and the feeling that is going on sort of between these boys at that particular time. And I think it's just a balancing act that writers have to sort of figure out at the end of their stories. You know, what is it that you want the reader to leave with, and how do you want them interacting with your stories? I'd much rather have a reader say, okay, what was that about, and then be able to sort of piece things together, then say, okay, that was satisfying, and close the
yes,
and
exactly.
Close the book.
Exactly. Yes. Speaking of endings, I'm so sorry. We've drawn down on our time.
Oh, no.
We have so much more to talk about.
What a cliffhanger.
I know. Any last minute words of writing advice for new aspiring writers?
No, just keep at it. And remember that the world is complicated. And so why not sort of allow that complication into your fiction?
I love it. Ethan Rutherford, you you exceeded all of my hopes for this interview. This was really, really, really wonderful. I really appreciate
it. It was really fun. Let's do it again soon.
I would love that. Keep writing so we can do it again soon.
Okay. Oh, no. Okay, I will.
That was Ethan Rutherford. The book is The Peripatetic Coffin, and he is great. Look him up online. He's got a great website. Stay with me. I will be right back here with Barry Newman in just a few moments. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under College Radio, or you can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, events, and more. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Barry Newman is with me now. Barry went to work for the Wall Street Journal in 1970 after a few years as a copy boy and news clerk for the New York Times. In 43 years at the Journal, he wrote more than 400 features for the front page from more than 65 countries and most states in the USA. He won the Overseas Press Club's Award for Explanatory Journalism and the National Press Club's Award for Humor Writing. His stories have been collected in several books, including East of the Equator, The Literary Journalists, and Floating Off the Page. News to Me is what we're talking about this morning, and it is my pleasure to welcome Barry on. Barry, hi.
Hi.
So I'm going to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the scope of these really wonderful essays, your decision to sort of share your trade tips and secrets with the outside world and kind of take us into the world of News to Me and how it came together.
Well, I am a long-time feature writer for a newspaper called the Wall Street Journal, and it is a newspaper and has been a newspaper ever since I joined it. But it was a weird newspaper. It's a little less weird today. It's more conventional. But when I joined the newspaper, it was more or less a magazine wrapped around a bulletin board for business. Mm. It had three stories on page one every day, and I came out of a news background. I was 23 years old, and I wanted to be a newspaper man, but I also wanted to get onto page one. And when I arrived at the Wall Street Journal, they told me that if I wanted to get onto page one, I had to write those stories. And those stories were unusual for the period, and they continued to be unusual for a long time. They were more like magazine stories, but at the same time, I was constrained by all the strictures of daily journalism in terms of personal opinion, being a being able to write in the first person, and so I developed a style which was in keeping with what that paper was like at the time, which involved what I have lately found out were novelistic techniques. And I was in the process of giving classes. People offered me a chance to come into journalism schools to give classes. And one of the people that invited me was a guy named Tim Harper at CUNY, City University of New York, Journalism School. And I was walking through my stories and how I got them for his classes, and he came to me one day and he said, "Why don't you do a book that would combine the stories themselves with some essays on how you got them?" And I thought this was a good idea because I don't read how-to books. I don't have the patience or the, I don't know, I don't connect with how-to books. And I don't much read long, collections of stories that are taken out of newspapers or magazines or other types of publications. But the idea of being able to put the whole story into a book with chatty sort of visits with the writer
was really appealing to me, because I used to like to read the Writers at Work essays that the Paris Review puts out.
Yeah.
And I loved being able to have a chance to just sort of feel what it's like to be one of these people. It's kind of comforting to know what a torture it is, and how even the greatest writers go through the same sort of periods of uncertainty and nervousness and agitation getting things done. And so I liked that. I liked that idea. And I wanted to make this a very casual sort of relationship with whoever might end up reading this. You know, when I was a kid and I worked at the New York Times, I was one of my jobs was called Nightside News Assistant on the Metropolitan Desk. And what happened with there was the man who was in charge of deciding whether a story was a story would sit at his desk, and reporters would line up, literally line up, to offer summaries of the stories that they had reported that day. And they would then be questioned by the editor, and they'd talk it through. And I sat there listening to these discussions, and I learned so much just by overhearing this wonderful guy, whose name was Shelley Binn, explained to reporters what the news was, what the angle was, how long the story was worth publishing. And I thought, well, if I could write these essays in the same way, just sitting around and talking with a reporter who's been through a lot of this stuff, people could learn something. I learn something every time I sit down to talk with a reporter, even now. And so that's why I thought it was a good idea, and I had fun doing it.
It sounds like a lot of on-the-job training, and a job that's really evolved, that your writing style evolved with the Wall Street Journal and with the paper, and I don't know. It sounds very organic to me that this first-person narrative has developed over time, as you've developed over time as a writer, that you kind of grew up into this style together.
I think what happened was that the Wall Street Journal style existed before I got there. Once I figured it out, I started to play with it and manipulate the formula until and adding certain things that were connected with my personality. And I think that everybody has an individual personality and can find ways to express that, even in a very restricted form. The wonderful thing about the Journal at that time was that I'm a New Yorker. I know I come from the outer boroughs of New York, Rockaway. I'm sitting here at my desk in Brooklyn, and I can look out over Prospect Park, and I can actually see where I come from. And it's out on the beach. But New Yorkers are different. There's a bit of a different way of dealing with life if you're a New Yorker. But the Wall Street Journal was full of Midwesterners, sort of wry, raw-boned people who didn't really take anything all that seriously. And I was amazed that there was this atmosphere of distance from the news of the day. There was a feeling that you could stand back and look at everything from the outside and see the absurdities and see the folly and see how other journalists got so involved in their stories that they couldn't stand back and understand the ironies and the absurdities. And that's what I learned when I got there. I learned to see everything from an outsider's point of view. And I think that if I evolved, it was even more into a feeling of being an outsider, never playing the game, never being too close to a beat. Most journalists are beat reporters. So I was able to do this on a newspaper, which is unusual.
Yeah.
Very few people stick to it as long as I did, and I stuck to being on this newspaper for a pretty basic reason, and I'm sure that many people who are struggling to to get into journalism today would be salivating with jealousy at the way the world worked in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even into the 2000s. The incredible wealth of an institution that was the largest circulation newspaper in the United States and had a captive audience because it was the only place you could go to see those little numbers in the back of the Wall Street Journal. You know, the reason Marilyn Monroe liked men who wore glasses was that they could read those little numbers in the back of the Wall Street Journal. Those people had to read the newspaper, and the paper was wealthy. So I was, when I was in my late 20s, I was sent out to Southeast Asia after the end of the Vietnam War. I didn't cover the Vietnam War. I was just told to go out there and find stuff and do things. And my beat extended all the way from Tahiti to India. And I was traveling constantly and building up a fantastic expense account, almost unconscious of the amount of money I was spending to do, you know, silly little stories in the South Pacific that today would seem almost incomprehensible to most, certainly to, I would think, all newspapers and many, many magazines. But I had a wonderful time, and I spent a little over 20 years overseas, and was always an outsider, always seeing the world from what I thought of as the perspective of the typical reader. The reader, originally, when I first went to the Journal, I was told that the reader was the little old lady in Dubuque. And the reason for that was that the New Yorker famously, New Yorker magazine famously said that it was not written for the little old lady in Dubuque. The Wall Street Journal, I was told that it was written for the little old lady in Dubuque. But I figured that that little old lady who probably probably owned 10 shares of AT&T was a very smart old lady, and she liked her writing clear and crisp with no frills and still absorbing and fascinating. And then in the 80s, the little old lady in Dubuque was replaced by the dentist in Akron, who also is an intelligent guy with who probably looks at the stock market once in a while, but who is open to all kinds of experiences in being exposed to the world in a way that was not boring. Right. So the whole enterprise for me was to probably, you know, not preach to the converted, to bring perspectives about the world to people who are open to them but not familiar with them. And I am a complete generalist, so that when I stumble onto a story, I am just as much of an ignoramus as my readers. I do so many different stories, I have never become a specialist in anything. So that I have managed to approach almost every subject that I encounter from scratch. So I keep trying to remember there's a Art Linkletter, who used to be a radio and TV personality, used to say that he knew enough about a lot of things to be interesting, but not so much about any one thing to be boring.
Right, right.
So that's the way I've approached my stories.
Well, you have such a wonderful sense of curiosity, and you know, there are so many wonderful essays in here, but there's a great essay on grape nuts and what the heck are grape nuts and are they grapes or are they nuts or they, and you know, as I was reading that, I was like, yeah, you know, why didn't I think about this before for the hundreds of times I've eaten grape nuts. And I was wondering if you think curiosity can sort of be taught, or how you tell journalists what to look at, what to look for, what, should you be looking at the center of the action, or should you be looking a little bit left to the center to see what's happening in the background to ignite more curiosity?
Well, you know, it's funny. I have questions. I look around the world and I think about why things are the way they are. And a lot of things seem a little bit bizarre to me. So that's my perception. I can tell you, if you're interested, why I did that grape nut story.
Yeah.
And maybe why other people didn't. But it leads back into another aspect of this kind of work, which is that one story leads to another. Every question leads to another question. I was in Poland, and I was doing a story about a program to destroy Cold War battle tanks. Both sides of the Cold War, the Warsaw Pact and NATO, had agreed to dismantle the tanks that were facing each other across the divide in Eastern Europe. And the Germans had a way of doing this, and I guess maybe the Americans, which involved blow torches. And dismantling a tank with this blow torch is a slow, labor-intensive process. But the Poles came up with a different idea. They made a gigantic steel ball and drove a tank into a kind of concrete bunker and used an electromagnet to raise this ball over the bunker and then dropped it onto the tank. And the tank was squashed like a cockroach. And I wrote a story about that, which I thought was pretty funny. It was called The Polish Method for Destroying Tanks. And I had a friend in Warsaw who used to work for a management consultant firm in the U.S., and one of his clients was Post, the cereal maker. And I came back to Warsaw, and I told him, you know, I just saw the way they make these, way they're destroying these tanks. And I explained it to him, and he stopped for a second, and he said, oh, that's how they make grape nuts.
I love it.
So for the next 14 years or so, I thought about that, and finally one day I picked up the phone, and I called the grape nuts people, and I said, can I come to your factory? Because I'd like to see how you make them. I thought, you know, it was hard enough to destroy battle tanks, but how do you make grape nuts? So that's how I did that story. And it's often the case that, you know, a question arises, or something seems inexplicable to me. And if I do a double take and I say, huh, that one word is enough to make me feel like there's a story to be done.
Yes, right. You have all of these wonderful notebooks. You said so far in the book you had 737 of them that are always on your person, except that one time when you were naked and it was close to your person but not on your person. And I wonder from a reporter's perspective, if you can sort of share with us the things you're looking for, what you write down in these notebooks, what the details are that you hone in on. You know, sometimes they're obvious, but sometimes I would think that they're very subtle. And you had included a couple of the notes that you had kept on people. And I thought, what a great observation. And again, is that something that can be taught?
I don't think you can teach it. I have, there are several different ways of absorbing what's going on around you. Some people wait until something happens and then they jot it down. I tend to pan for gold. I tend to write down everything. Sometimes I use a tape recorder, but even that is not good enough because your eye and your ear perceive things and define things, snippets of conversation, bits of observation, little movements, and so forth, that no camera or tape recorder will ever perceive. So I look for the kind of detail that will create a scene, things that are, you could call them events, but they're events in the most minor possible way. You have to keep your perceptions very. You have to be very intense about picking up things that you would not normally pick up. Whether it's a person looking at his plate and saying, you know, this pork chop is tough, or someone moving a tea bag in a cup of hot water, things that create what I would call tiny little points of event that create scenes. I often try to interview more than one person at a time, so that I get them talking among themselves. And when I was using interpreters, and I used interpreters for years, I tried to explain to them that what I wanted them to interpret was not just the question and answer session. I wanted everything. I wanted a torrent of small things. And then I would go through my notes and try to extract something that a novelist would use for a scene, whether it is a physical description, a situation, a dialogue, and in each case I would try to find a way to make that scene mean something, to reflect an aspect of the story that I'm writing, to be different from the next scene. To me, the essential sort of goal that I have or have had was to do something other than a normal newspaper story, and then something other than frequently magazine stories, although most magazine stories would want to follow this sort of pattern. But if you read a news story, you often find a statement of some sort of a fact backed up by statistics and historical observations or some sort of context like that. And then there'll be a quote from a talking head, somebody who is essentially supporting what you already said in your previous paragraph. I try to replace those talking heads with scenes, with observation, with perceptions of my own, and that I think is an important difference. The scene. I went for years trying to avoid ever including a disembodied quote in a story, somebody who is an expert on something. I probably disappointed a lot of academics after I interviewed them forever and then never quoted them. but I tried to support and verify the work of academics or sociologists with observable detail, things that I could use to shore up and to really bring to life the mundane, the boring stuff that that could be just dealt with on a very easy way, an easy level, by a disembodied quote. And I tell you, my efforts to get scenes take up almost all my time. The fundamental message in this book, News to Me, is to get out of the office. I have been watching people sitting in offices for the last maybe 10 or 15 years. What amazed me was that the office didn't clear out during the middle of the day. In a big newspaper, usually the place is empty until deadline time, because everybody used to be out there gathering the news, right?
Right.
And then something happened. People started staying in the office and becoming, you know, mesmerized by these screens.
Right.
And you know, to me, getting out of the office is the only way to do these things. And it's bizarre, but you can argue that it's time consuming to get out of the office, and it is. At, you know, once in a while this happens. I've done a lot of very long trips just to get one scene. And I could tell you about those, but
we have to have you back on. We've run out of time. We have to have you back on.
It's also true that when you get out of the office and you spend 3 hours observing things and or being with some people or talking to people and doing something with them, that's half your story right there. I don't think it's inefficient to get out of the office and see things and do things. There is a culture in the United States that I find frustrating, that people are willing to talk to you on the phone, like we're doing now, but they're less likely to let you into their homes or their factories, their offices, and so forth. When I was overseas, it was the opposite. It was impolite and inconceivable to carry on telephone interviews, and American reporters who came over to Asia or to Europe and tried to work the phones would be frustrated because people just didn't understand that. They wanted to see you.
Yeah.
So that made this kind of reporting really wonderful because I could always see people, and there would always be an opportunity to get a scene. People will often say, I mean, I have a line in this book, it's an invention, but, you know, if you want to do a story about a fire-eating escape artist, and if you call him up, he'll say, gee, I'd love to give you an interview, but I'm too busy escaping and eating fire this week. Could we do it next week? And I say, no, I want to be there when you're escaping and eating fire. That's what I'm doing. And it takes some time and effort to convince people to let you be with them when they are doing the thing that you're writing about.
Well, I want to be with you more, but we've drawn down on our time. I'm so sorry.
Oh, already?
I'm so sorry. I know. It blew through, right? It blew through. There's always more to talk about. And I was going to say, I usually end on you giving advice, but the book, I have to tell people, is full of so much great, wonderful advice. It really takes you inside your life and your work, and it's such a treat. I really, really loved it, Barry.
Well, I just want to say that it's not advice. It's an example. Everybody does it their own way.
Yeah.
This is, I'm an exhibit. I'm not, this is not, these are not orders, but I think if you learn how somebody else does it, you can get something going in your own head about how you want to do it, because this is an individual enterprise.
It's great. It's great. Barry, Barry Newman, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
You're welcome.
This was wonderful.
You're welcome.
You should absolutely check out Barry's book, News to Me, Finding and Writing Colorful Feature Stories. That's all we have time for today. Nicole will be back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.